Hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and this is the second episode of the brand new series of Philosophy. We're trying to bring it to you every week now with thanks from Mike Howell, our US-based audio producer, and young podcast Mike, who's now come on board to wrangle guests and book in interviews and make all this magic happen, put it on social media and all that sort of stuff. So if you're hitting us up on Twitter or Facebook at our Philosophy pod sites, then young Mike, podcast Mike. This is confusing for me. How can it? I'm trying to explain it to you and I don't even understand it myself. There are two men who help bring you this podcast. Their names are both Michael. It's a little bit confusing. Young Mike, podcast Mike, is running the socials because he's a young person and knows how to do those sort of things. James Fosdyke, of course, does all the wonderful, beautiful original art for each episode. And if you would like to support this podcast in any way, we have a TOFOP, T-O-F-O-P, Patreon page, patreon.com/TOFOP, and you can go there and support all of our podcasts. And some of that money obviously goes to James and to Mike Howell and to young podcast Mike to help them make these episodes happen. So there you go. I don't really make any money out of it. We might get a sponsor at some stage and it might start paying for itself. But at the moment, it costs me a bit of money to make each of these episodes. So if you can chip in a bit, or if you can just come and see me live, that's the best way to do it. If I'm coming to your town and you want to come and see a live show, that way you get a live show, but you're also helping support the podcast. My new tour is called Willegal. When you hear this, it'll be on at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. That's my home festival. Melbourne is the city that is most supportive to me in my career and has been for all my life. And I've just moved home to Melbourne for the very first time since I started out there in the Melbourne comedy scene. So it's a very exciting time for me to bring a show that is incredibly personal to me. And I've just done a weekend, as I'm recording this, of shows in Brisbane, and the show has come together really, really well. So I'm very excited about taking it to Melbourne and showing it to the people of Melbourne. After that, I'll be off to Canberra, off to Perth, off to Sydney, and a bunch of other places as we add dates later on in the year. But all those places are already on sale, so come out and see a show. Today's episode is with the fabulous Hamish Blake. Now, this is pretty exciting. Got to sit down with Hamish. We only had a limited period of time because I had to go and get an MRI on my little neck tumor. It's fine. It's benign. But I had to go and get it that day just so they could check it out. It's been stopping my breathing a bit. So we just thought that was something that probably should get investigated. It's just one of those things when you only talk for a living that breathing is kind of important to what you do. So I thought I might as well get it checked out. We touch on that a little bit in the podcast. As is our want, we just start talking at the start of this one before I really start the podcast. But it's such interesting stuff that I just thought we'd let it roll and leave it all in. Hamish, really, probably more than any other guest on this podcast, needs no introduction. He is one half of the most iconic radio duo in Australia in the last 10-15 years. He is a brilliant, brilliant comic talent in his own right, one of the most naturally funny people on the entire planet. Just one of those people who brings funny to the table in all situations. He's incredibly charming. He's incredibly nice. He and Andy, as a radio partnership, but also as people, have an amazingly grounded and positive view of what can be a very competitive and tough business. I remember running into them early on one time, and we'd been making some jokes about Hamish and Andy on the Glasshouse, a show that we did a long time ago. And I remember running into them and being overwhelmed by how nice they were about the idea that we were making a few jokes at their expense. And they said, well, you know, if we got mad at you, then that would mean that hot dogs from Big Brother would get mad at us. And I love the way that they understood the broader picture of the industry. I've been nothing but pleased for their success. And now, at a time in their life where they're still doing Hamish and Andy things, they're also going off in their own directions to do separate things. So we start talking about Hamish and Andy, but really, this podcast was to catch up with Hamish himself, Hamish by himself, and a guy that I've known for a fair while but never had an opportunity to have one of these chats with, which is basically the purpose of this entire podcast. So I think you're going to like this one. I'm not going to talk for much longer because, you know what, you just want to get into it and have a listen to the fabulous Hamish Blake. So here you go. Hope you enjoy it.
This could just check for levels.
Yeah, exactly.
But me and Andy went all the way over to Cannes one year to, we got to, somehow there was a junket, I think it was a Village Roadshow thing. And of course, like, no one else could go because, like, yeah, you could speak to Robert Downey Jr., but like, why are you going to move your whole show for 5 days to France to talk to Robert Downey Jr.? Like, there was just, but we had a Saturday morning show, so we're like, yeah, we'll go to Cannes and do one interview, talk to Robert Downey Jr. And we had those mini discs that they were like massive Marantz. Remember those? Like, yep. You had like a satchel. It was like the nuclear codes. Like, the president has like a massive satchel. They took, I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say, at least 12, maybe 16 AA batteries. Like, they had those canisters you pulled out and for a mini disc.
Right.
Chatted to it. And you had to jam paper in the end of the battery cartridge. It was like ammo. Like, you had to like jam all the batteries and put paper in, and the paper came out, which meant the battery disconnected, and we just lost the Robert Downey Jr. interview.
Because the paper came out.
Because the bit of paper came out.
The bit of paper that was holding the whole operation together came out.
The higher quality paper that was denser. More grams per inch or whatever it is. And so then we had to like...
We just can't get paper in France. That's the problem.
So we only had 4.5 minutes with Robert Downey Jr. too. They had a shot clock on. And so by the time we like made small talk with him going, oh, great, look, we're going well with Robert Downey Jr., we looked at the shot clock and it was like 2:57, 2:56. So we just had to say to people like, we lost our interview. We're so sorry. And luckily they had TV cameras set up in there and they're like, oh, yeah, we rolled on it for you with our TV camera. You can have this giant Betacam tape, which we had no idea what to do with, but we were able to like salvage it. That's why Radio Mike's here.
So for some reason, I did an interview by myself. I think Adam might have been away. So when we were at Triple J, and it was with a very popular Hollywood celebrity of the time, who I won't name because I know where this story's going. But
are they still popular? Like, are they still got the?
She had a very big franchise. She was anyway. It was Renee Zellweger, guys. Okay.
And I won't name her, but let's do 4 minutes of clues.
Yeah, exactly. You would all guess who it is. Plus, we actually played the tape on air, so you could go back and find out who it was. I don't know why I thought I was keeping a secret. But anyway, at the end of the interview, I said, you know, my on-air partner, Adam isn't here today. So, you know, can you say something to make him jealous? And she goes, oh, I'll do better than that. And she gets up and she kisses me. We're alone in a hotel room together and I'm recording an interview with her and she kisses me. I mean, to be honest, this is a reverse Me Too situation now that I say it out loud.
But there's no, you're not really complaining about this one. This is not like when Russell Brand does this to interviewers, everyone's like, whoa.
Yeah, when we played it on air, it wasn't me giving the evidence for the class action I was going to put together against Bridget Jones.
True. There's not many other people going, oh my God, Catherine Zeta-Jones did that to me. This has got to stop.
But it had recorded so badly because I had to do it all myself and I'm terrible at it.
And your hands were shaking after the kiss.
Well, the thing was that the kiss, like, again, it's a kiss. So it wasn't like I took the microphone up to record the kiss. So A, it's been recorded badly, and B, it's like way off mic, this kiss.
No one believes you.
But it was so important that we were just like, whatever you can do, get everyone involved in Triple J into this studio, see if they can ramp up the sound.
Enhance. Yeah. I need to hear some sort of lip suction somewhere on my lips.
Call ASIO. You know those people in crime TV shows where they get the audio and they're able to isolate it and hear a background character? Yeah. We need those guys.
You need like that shitty ghost hunting show on Foxtel where they go in with those super high density mics and they're like, and if we slow it down, we can just hear which is a ghost's footsteps leaving the room.
By the way, guys, please turn off that blue light. That's completely unnecessary to bring in here. Hello and welcome to Willosophy. My name is Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. Joining me is a man who you may have already guessed who it was from the fact that he kept referring to this guy called Andy. But I ask every question of our guests anyway. What is who are you?
I'm Hamish Blake. Name and rank. Hamish, assistant to Mr. Andy Lee. Thank you for having me.
It is. Well, it's nice to have you here by yourself because you guys are in a part of your world and career and, you know, life at the moment where you're still working together, but you've stopped, you know, working together on the radio. You've got a podcast on Podcast One that people can listen to, but there is an element of you both going off and doing your own things. And I'm interested in that is like when you have had a partnership that has been so intrinsic to your career, but also intrinsic in the public's mind to your identities.
True.
What is it like when you're going out there doing stuff by yourself?
I think we're probably at a stage now where we're both, you know, and for a bit of background, we're coming out of probably, I would say, like a solid 12 years of Hamish and Andy being either a radio show or a TV show. Probably coming, the exciting part is like we don't have to be Hamish and Andy now. Not that we had to be it, but like we were always involved in things where it would be dumb to have a huge fight and go, I hate you. Like in the middle of gap year, it would be weird to be like, you know what? I think I want to make greeting cards and just leave Andy in the jungle. So there's always that thing in the back of my mind where it was like, right, we're doing this. We are Hamish and Andy. You know, we don't not like being Hamish and Andy, but there's no chance that there's no reason to think about it. So now we're probably at a stage where it's like, well, you know, the radio show has come to an end. We've got no real solid plan of what comes next. So it's like, in a way, at a minimum, it's a good chance to go, all right, well, let's just double check that we want to still do this, because of what it became, like Hamish and Andy has become, or it became this thing, it was like, it's like almost like it became very easily, well, not successful, but like it was easy for people to tap into it. Like, it's so easy for people to go like, that's just you guys. You're Hamish and Andy. You're the best friend. Like, it's a very easy handle for people. And it's so easy. So it's like, all right, well, that's kind of like a really tempting thing to have out there all the time. But let's make sure we want to do it rather than just do it because, like, it's so much easier to just be Hamish and Andy than to try something else, whether it's together or as an individual. So I'm sure there's stuff that Ando wants to do. And I think we've always been a pretty good place as mates to go, well, we know we've got this thing that works. We love doing it, but let's... I think this is a great spot to be in now. And we've had this moment a few times in our careers where it's like, we don't have to be Hamish and Andy. So if we do keep doing stuff as Hamish and Andy, it's great because we know in our hearts it means we want to do it, rather than if we just signed a 10-year deal to, you know, host right. a talent show as Hamish and Andy, we'd have to be Hamish and Andy. So
contractually obliged to be Hamish and
it's
Andy.
It's so much nicer yeah. to just choose to be by Hamish choice. And Andy.
We are Hamish and Andy by choice. We are Hamish and or Andy, yeah. depending on the situation.
Hamish and ... I guess Andy.
Andy? Possibly Andy as well.
And he's in there going, I guess it's I'm with Hamish. So it's really fun. Like, I love this stage. I'm not in a rush to do the next thing because I like this kind of moment of calm, because I feel like it'll mean that the next thing, whatever the next thing that happens, either personally or with Ando, is just 100% by choice, which is good. It's refreshing because we work in a commercial world. It would be so easy to lose sight of the fact that it should be a choice. Do you know what I mean? Like, the thing I keep coming back to is like, you don't have to do any of this. No one has to do any of this. Like, even if something's successful, like if a show's going well, you don't have to do it. So just make sure you want to do it. Like, you know.
I'm always surprised that from a public point of view, how often they, particularly I'm back in the breakfast radio world, and I'm always like stunned at the level of interest that people have as if you're doing it against your will. Yes. You know, their big questions are always like, oh, how do you get up in the morning? It's like, oh, well, I chose to do it.
Yes, I looked at the options.
I was of the understanding that...
No one says that to like people that have real jobs either. Right. Like construction workers, like, oh, man, how do you do it? 7 o'clock how start on a work site. Right. You go because you chose to do it.
Well, everyone mentions the 5:30 start, but no one mentions the 9:30 finish. No one mentions the fact that it's 10 a.m. and we're doing this and I'm at home.
Well, now we've had the reverse where we're like, you know what? I think we'll just stop for a while. And everyone's like, I don't understand. Because there's only two ways to finish in media.
Right.
You either get fired and then that's a great headline, or you explosively quit. No one can just say, I did something for a while and now I'm going to stop doing this thing and I'm going to see what else I want to do. Like Jessica Rowe the other day. She's just like, hey, you know what? I've worked here for a while. I think I'm going to stop and I'm going to spend some time with my kids. And everyone's like, she's dropped a bombshell on air. Like, you're allowed to stop doing things. The people, I don't think like the world of headlines doesn't like someone just going, we did something for a while. Yeah. We had a lot of fun. We're going to do something else. Like, no, don't buy it. What was it? A falling out? Come on. Fuckers, what is it? Like, something's happening. You tell us what the plan is.
Well, you two are meant to hate each other for 10 years and then have a reunion.
Like,
you know,
where's the blow up? You can't just be friends and decide to pursue interests.
There's got to be a confidence in it as well, though, because I think that for both of you, there's got to be a confidence in it, because I think that often the reason perhaps that those relationships become a thing that permanently has to happen is one or the other people thinks that they can't survive by themselves. Whereas I think you both are at a stage of your careers and lives where you're happy to go, no. Like, totally. I wish the other person great success in whatever it is that they pursue. It doesn't threaten the idea that, you know, we have this other thing.
100%. And I mean, the whole reason Ando and I do...
Doesn't matter how good the Black Panther spin-off movie is, he'll still be there for the Avengers.
Very, very happy for you. Very, very happy. Well done. Congratulations on your Oscar. I mean, Key & Peele's probably a pretty good... Key & Peele would be a great example because, like, well done. You've got an Oscar nomination, but we're still buddies. Yeah.
Remember our sketches we did? Remember how I was Obama? That was pretty funny. too as well.
I was there for the start. I was there for the start.
Remember that time you said something really funny on set and I said, get out. And you got the inspiration for your Oscar?
That was me. So, yeah, I mean, like, going back to the start, like, I've often thought of this. I'm like, how did we just become, like, what? We were never like, you know, hi, I'm Hamish, hi, I'm Andy. Like, let's be a duo. It's, and growing up, I was never like, God, I can't, you know, love to be in a duo when I grow up. So it wasn't, the thoughts occurred to me many times. I reckon it just naturally, the reason it probably naturally evolved is probably a mix of getting confidence from each other and a bit of a, well, this seems to be the, like this avenue kind of keeps opening up rapidly with opportunities where we just seem to be able to complement each other well to do the tasks that are ahead of us. So I think it came a lot from the fact, and from early days, we've just realized that there's something within the dynamic where we've just, you know, it sounds cheesy, but you just got that thing that complements each other. Like, if we were both.
I'm fascinated though by the complementary nature of the relationship, because I think that speaks to something very much, which is that idea of finding someone else who, you know, A, brings some stuff to the table that you can't bring to the table, but B, that stuff doesn't get in your way. That stuff, yeah, it lifts you up.
Yeah, and you begin to realize as the years go on just what those superpowers are that the other person has. And so you think, and I've made this mistake too, you think, like, if there's someone that's really similar to you, you're like, oh man, it'll be so much fun to just hang out with them. And it is fun to hang out, but it doesn't really work if you're doing a show together. As you know, like, you're not doing a show with Eddie Maguire because you guys are two peas in a pod.
Oh, no, that's why. We have. That was why.
And I thought it was like, you know, I thought it was weird that he's your housemate.
What I'd really like to do is talk about the history of Collingwood every single day.
So you realize, like, oh, you actually do need to kind of work with someone that's a little bit different. Different friend on, because, you know, we are mates, we are similar, but we're not. You know, there's other people that are probably, that I've, like, you know, that you hang out with or whatever, where you're like, all right, you're, in a weird way, like, whatever it is I do, you do what I do as well. And that's not, that doesn't make for a good relationship. And so we've found someone in each other. Like, I found Andy, he found me. We're like, all right, well, we do something that's pretty similar, but it really complements, you know, where I'm going with my head is a place you're really happy to go, but we're not going to do the same things when we get there. And conversely, like, where he's going with his head is a place I'm really happy to go, but I'm not going to do the same things when we arrive at that situation either. So it's obvious, like, our Venn diagrams don't completely overlap. So you end up getting a lot, if you want to talk about the surface area of two circles, you end up getting a lot.
Which
larger,
is exactly what I did want to talk about.
Comedy.
So thank God you brought it up.
It's a combination of the surface area of two circles that don't completely overlap. So with Ando, like, from, you know, it took us a long time to kind of, like, nail down what it is we did. And we've never really had, it's not like we have a discussion to be like, hey, remember that's a Hamish job or that's an Andy job. That's why I suppose it takes 12 years, because it's intuitive and it's hard to describe, but there's always going to be a thing between Ando and I where, like, we know what we do, even if it's hard to describe to other people, and you'd intrinsically know how to play a situation.
One of the things I'm interested in that regard, because one of the things I've been thinking about a lot and probably having to explain to people a lot recently, so that's why it's top of my mind, but is the idea that I think that I prefer work relationships where I'm not friendly with the person. I've had my share of everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I find, in a work sense, going into an office with a bunch of people that you work with, I find that an easier way to deliver feedback about what it is that I need or things that are, you know, maybe not working in the show, you know, because you're in a professional environment, you're not going to have to be friends with those people later and worry about, like, you know, how it affects your friendship. So I'm interested, because you and Andy are friends, like, what was it like delivering, what was that process of, like, delivering feedback to each other the show and what each of you were feeling about the show?
There's definitely concessions you end up making with your friendship, because at some point along the track we realized, again without it really being conscious, but it's probably about the time where it becomes your actual job, we're like, all right, well, we've commercialized our friendship, like, we've weaponized it somehow, and now it's not as trivial. Like, we can't just be, you know, when you're buddies with someone, it's like a friendship is a thing that you're working on every day. And, like, sometimes you're falling out of contact with people. You might not chat to a friend for 6 months, then you might go on holidays together. We're like, well, we can't really have that flippancy anymore with our relationship, because now it's like, this is somehow our livelihood, our relationship. So in the same way that, yeah, like, even if you're a comedian or a writer, the super successful ones are the ones that get up in the morning, like, at 9 o'clock, I'm working. Like, even if I'm working from home, you know, I'm at work and I'm writing and there's that discipline to it. So I suppose it's that you end up introducing an element of discipline into your friendship, because like anyone that's working, you have to have an element of discipline. So you introduce that element of we introduce that element of discipline in our relationship, which is like every day we're turning up and we're here to make the show. And naturally, like that outside of work, you probably see each other less socially. You know, we still drive into work together and hang out, but you're talking about, you've got this thing that, you know, you do, especially in our 20s too. Like the show was our lives. Like we lived Hamish and Andy and we just gave our lives over to it. So we probably had 16 contact hours with each other a day, yet then outside when it was time to decompress, we would probably seek out other relationships and other mates, because we're like, well, we knew that like for our job we needed that variety too. We needed to be able to come to the table and be different people and not just live together. But
yeah, it's very hard to feel the mic break with, what did you get up to last night? You know, you were there.
Oh, I was at dinner with this guy. Yeah. Who was you?
It was you.
And he was really annoying. Listen to what this fucking guy said at dinner.
Is this a bad way to bring this up? But
pretend it wasn't you for a second. Yeah. I hated this guy's opinions.
Just the way he chews really annoys me.
You got it. I'm going to take a recorder next time. I go for dinner with this guy. So back to your point about going like, after trying all the different iterations of working relationships, there's a real sense to going, I'm at work, this is what we do. We make funny stuff, but at the end of the day, we do it for an audience, and we're the show, and we got people whose jobs rely on this, so let's be professional about it. So we had to introduce that element, but I think, like, luckily, just trying to think about it now, because I've never really delved too deep into this stuff, but it probably comes down to the sense that we both have an idea of what's the right way to behave with people and in a team, and we were able to make that leap to go, when we're at work, these are the set of, like, this is how we believe you should behave in a team framework. And I think we've probably both got, like, Ando's a good leader. He's a good manager. And I'm happy being a soldier to some extent. Like, I'm just much rather have a clear set of things to do and I can do them. And I don't need to be running meetings and stuff. I'm actually much rather be doodling on my pad and then having an idea somewhere because I'm checked out of the meeting. But luckily, we just managed to fall into a framework that had the right level of respect and I think the same attitudes towards being in a team. I would say it comes down to that.
I'm interested in, and again, this is not 60 Minutes, so if we get into any area that you don't want to talk about, we don't have to talk about it, you know. But
shout out to Mamma Mia or Daily Mail, who's combing the podcast for juicy grabs.
Exactly. Do you have a bonk fan in the workplace? No, I mean, the interesting thing is, to me, is to the nature of having, you know, a wife and a family.
Yep.
For most people, their partner is, you know, identifiable to everybody as being the Andy to their Hamish, if you know what I'm saying, right? Like in real life, normally your partner is that person, the person that you talk to the most, that you talk about your most intimate things, that you share all your stories about your life. If something funny happens at dinner or someone was annoying you, you talk to it with your partner. But when you're in a partnership, a professional partnership like that, where you're doing those same things.
True.
How does it affect the rest of your life? Like, you're not getting up in the morning and having a 3-hour conversation about everything
with my wife.
With your wife. Yeah. You know, you don't. You don't have that level of, well, or do you?
I mean, this is weird tautology, but Zoe is my Andy. Like Zoe's, I think Zoe's what the
There's
public.
There's your headline.
I think Zoe's my Andy. I think Zoe's what the public thinks. And my Andy, yes. You know, the Andy is like, for what the public see Hamish and Andy being, Zoe's my real life. You know, she's, you know, I have more contact hours with Zoe than I do with Ando.
Yep.
So she is that confidant, but then I've got Ando for the whole other side of our lives, which is the whatever we're making and the work world. But yeah, I do. So in that respect, I only say that because it's like, I don't think I'm like getting home and then Zoe's going, how come we're not talking? And I go, I've done all my talking today.
Right.
I've had FaceTime with my confidant. I don't really need you. But
well, I mean, I think there can be an element of that though. If you are like constantly having to produce content and you've had to like go through this, you know, moment or this thing, that idea of going home and then having to, you know, I mean, I imagine if somebody's been bricklaying all day, they don't want to come home and have to knock up the barbecue at 7 o'clock at night. You know, there can be.
But I suppose the great thing about what I've got with Zoe here's this is not the headline because it surprises no one. She's not really like Andy.
Right.
If I can just shock you.
Okay, well, there you go. We got
married,
it, finally.
I haven't married a female Andy. She's a very different...
Andy in a wig.
Different world.
It's like, it's like the Bugs Bunny
honey,
version of Andy.
Me, talk a bit more about Carlton, would you? So there's, you know, I mean, I do have a massively separate life to Ando, which, yeah, he's, you know, and he's got a massively separate life to me with his family and his friends, and especially having a wife and kids. Yeah. It's like, you know, there is that, it's the age-old adage, but there's just that massive divide between once you sort of have kids and you get sucked into that world.
It was having kids something that you always thought that you would do?
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah. I love being a dad. And I was very keen to be a dad from... Yeah, I didn't have that moment where I was like, well, I had a wild 20s and I never thought I'd have kids. It was an inevitability for me. I love it. It's the best.
Yeah, what is it that you love about it?
Well, this could be the slow run up into the what's your philosophy?
Or ever the professional. It's like we should get this philosophy thing at some stage.
Guys, I just feel like we're losing people with all this Andy chat. They've tuned in for philosophy. Like quite simply, I mean, I'm just trying to think of a way to put this, which doesn't sound like it's been said by everyone else. But it can, you know, it's just for the first time properly in my life, especially coming out of a period in my 20s and the early 30s where I'm like, our lives were about the show, which is a little bit narcissistic. It's, you know, it was great fun to dedicate our lives to those adventures. But then something comes along that's truly not about you. And it's like... And I mean this in not, this is not, this is going to sound a bit macabre, but I had this experience where as soon as Sonny was born and I was holding him, he's almost four, Sonny, and then a little girl, Rudy. It really hit me. And maybe this happens to everyone, but maybe not, but it really, like in the first few minutes of his life, I was holding him and I just suddenly went, oh my God, I'm going to die.
Right.
Like it just hit me. I was like, oh, I will die. I will die. Like I had a real sense of, but now it's your turn. Like now this is, now you're, I'm holding one of the newest human beings on the planet and they're the next generation. And I know Zoe had been pregnant for 9 months. I'd very much noticed it at home that her body was changing. So it's like, I knew we were having this baby, but that thought hadn't occurred to me that like, now you're a dad and then like, you're now not the newest generation. Like that's it. I was really at peace with that. I was like, oh, great. Now all I've kind of got to do is make sure that I give this little thing that I already am in love with the right tools to hopefully, fix climate change and all the other issues we're leaving them. But
yeah. I mean, it's a lot to put in the hands of one kid, but you're really...
And I was trying to write this all on his card. Because like, anyway, but mostly I just want to say welcome and how are you?
Hi, welcome. I'm your dad. I've just realised that I'm not immortal.
I'm having an existential crisis.
Neither is the planet.
My mortality,
books about climate change.
My mortality is crashing down on me, and so is the fact that even the planet is finite. Anyway, we'll get to that after you've gone through your Peppa Pig and Wiggle stage. But this is a roundabout way of answering the question, like, why do I love being a dad? Because it's, I think a lot of people, you know, you spend a lot of time pouring a lot of work into yourself and into the show and stuff. And it's just, you know, if after that experience of doing that especially in our industry, like to now pour energy into a little person, it just feels very worthwhile to me. And it will only matter to them, I hope, if it does at all. But to spend a day for me on the mat or like this morning just playing bongos with my little girl, it just seems super worthwhile. So I'm a little bit obsessed with I think different people, I've always had this belief, but now I've read a bit more, I come across it in other people's worlds where it's like called the 75-year-old test or whatever. But I'm a bit obsessed with the belief of going, if I was 80 and I could jump back to this moment, what would I give? You know, like how much would you give to just be, even if you think like, you know, oh, I'm a bit sick or oh, I'm tired, you know, I'm 36 and my kids are babies. Like I know you'd give everything. Like I just know you'd give all the money in the world to be back here for 10 minutes because, you know, we'll never get this chance to live this moment again. And I'm obsessed with that thought all the time with my kids. And it makes every moment super valuable. Like, you know, you only have, there's that old adage of going, you don't have as much time as you think, and you're not actually spending the time the way you think you're spending it. Like, you probably think you're spending heaps of time with your friends and family, but you're probably spending a lot of time on Instagram and just watching shit at night on TV. And if you could tell your 80-year-old self, oh yeah, you know, here's this thing that's now worth to you like $10 million for 10 minutes back when you were 36. And at the time when you were 36, you spent that thing just flicking through a Rebel Sports catalog, bored, flicking bits of Weet-Bix off the kitchen counter. You'd be like, well, I feel like I squandered that a little bit. So for me, it's about memory making. Like that, I really believe my core life philosophy is about trying to create the best memories and the best inputs for the people around me and for my kids now.
Okay, well, that speaks to your philosophy. Is that your philosophy? Is that what you're saying?
If I had to drill down on it, like, what do I really care about spending my time on in life? It would be trying to make sure it's not squandered. Trying to make sure I'm not just flipping through life waiting for something else to happen, and that you can be present with the people you like. Because I kind of think that at the end of the day, that's like, what else really matters? Like, you want to really be sure you're spending your time on the right stuff.
It's interesting because this resonates with me about you, because so much of even the entertainment that you have made has been about experiences.
True,
you know, it's not been necessarily about, you know, a lot of radio, including the radio show I do, is mostly, to be honest, about, you know, commenting on other people's experience. You're talking, you know, about to a footballer about what they're doing, whereas a lot of your entertainment over the journey has been about actually creating your own experiences and then, you know, making the entertainment out of that. So yep, it is actually a very different approach in a lot of ways. The amount of people who I'm sure over the years have, because of the success of you guys, been told that they need to do some sort of Hamish and Andy style thing, but it's not intrinsic to them. It was intrinsic to you.
That we would always get that feedback sort of flying back to us going, oh man, you know, we have to go and, I don't know, you like ride a tandem bike around the CBD for 5 hours because we were told that would get attention. We're like, well, if you don't want to do it, it will get the wrong attention. Like, we're not doing it because we're like, man, I hate this. I just want to talk. I really, really, really just want to talk about chess, but we have to go and ride the tandem bike. Like, it just, that kind of shits and giggles bubbled to the forefront of what Andy and I thought was funny. And I don't know where it came from, but that floats our boat. We were like, let's do weird things. I think we both really get off on inventing a weird world and then like creating rules for it,
right?
So that you can't disobey. We're like, you know, like.
But is there a bigger sort of philosophical, you know, thing about that, which is this idea that we're living in a world that is only defined by the stupid rules we put in place anyway. Like, I mean, all of human existence is us trying to work out, like, none of us know what the rules are.
Totally.
So instead what we do is
we
make up these firm rules about these things where we go, well, someone just made up this rule at some stage.
And I'm sure we live thousands of them all the time that we don't even really think about. Like, I mean, I actually think just coming along here today, like, why do we pick 60 Ks an hour as the speed limit? Like, that has always struck me as a bit like, I know it's, like, I guess it works. Like, people still die at 60, but it, like, along the way, we've gone, oh, but, it, you know, not too many, so.
Right.
But, like, I guess we're all fine with that as the speed limit.
Margin of error.
Yeah. But we were all just like, well, that's the rules. That's 60. Because I'm like,
oh, you can drink some alcohol.
Yeah,
right.
We pick this number.
Yeah, two or three drinks.
But people,
depending on who you are.
People still die.
Have
a
crack.
Yeah, but, you know, people are dying all the time.
It's an acceptable.
let's not get too worried about it.
So death came up and your response to it was interesting to me, because that, I think death defines a lot of what, you know, the rest of how you decide to live your life is defined by how you, your attitude to death. And a lot of the time you hear about people having kids and realizing their own mortality, but it comes with a heaviness and a darkness to it, which is that I now have a reason. Like, I think for me, I'll put it from my perspective rather than trying to put it in other people's worlds. I can die whenever and life will go on
fine. Don't brag.
Yeah. But you know, like,
I can juggle.
Imagine that. And I was like, that's my power play.
You know what?
I was like, well, you know,
it's death, man. Yeah. He can die whenever.
Mate, you've got two kids and a wife. They'll give a shit if you die. I could die now. No one would care. Michael had finished the fucking interview with you.
Yeah,
It'd be his moment. This is why he comes around every time.
There'd be a brief 30 seconds of organ music that the listeners would hear while we cleaned up the body. But yeah, then we'd just finish the interview.
Welcome to Mike Osterfield.
Well, I'll be right back after this. We've had another host die. But I know what you mean. You're in the sense that you could die and there would be less. I mean, people would still
less
care.
Less impact
still got
on
friends
the world
and family.
Yeah, but they'd be fine. They've got other friends and other family.
I've been making this claim for years, so they're ready for it.
I'm not the last kid. Like, you know what I mean? Like, my brother and sister are both younger and healthier.
Well, if I could speak on your parents' perspective, I'm sure they would still notice.
They'd notice, but
you're not the complete grey man. Like, yeah. Australia would notice. But
I also don't ring them often enough that they'd be like, well, that's Sunday night freed up for maths.
So I suppose what you're saying is like the weird thing about the parent thing is, you know what I reckon terrifies parents, especially when your kids are young and Sonny's four, Rudy's 8 months, or Sonny's just about to be four. I'm not sure when the podcast comes out. This could be on his birthday. Happy birthday, mate. But
what is he a listener?
Yeah. Dad, where's my present? Oh no, I did a shout out on Will's podcast for you. Happy fourth birthday. So, do you know what I reckon it is? I am terrified of it. There's definitely fear involved, and there's a few different fears. I'm scared because my biggest fear is that they would not understand how much I love them.
Right.
Right. And that would real. That's you know. It's really simple, but I just think 90% of a kid's diet has to be love. Like, I just can't see a better way to spend my day than doing other actions or words with my kids. They're just like, hey, your dad loves you. I just think you're terrific. I want to hang out with you. I want to play Play-Doh with you. I want to hear what you think. I want to talk to you about your dad. I don't want to interrupt you. I want to give you space to talk and wander. And, we went looking for a cat on the weekend for 3 hours. Cat Stevens, who was lost in the neighborhood. Like, we saw posters up. And I was like, look, I know we're not going to find Cat Stevens, but like, let's go on for an adventure. Let's have fun because I want you to remember. I want your...
Unfortunately, Cat Stevens had changed his name to Yusuf Islam Cat.
But well, I like. I want your memories of your childhood to be like your dad cares and he's here and he loves you. But you know they're kids and they can't fathom that yet. And I reckon that's why parents are like, shit, don't die. You have to get to a stage where kids are like, you can have an adult conversation with them and be like, hey, I literally only care about you being okay in life. So there's probably that little fear too. But once maybe that goes like once your kids hit an age where they'll be like, all right, dad, stop. I get it. You don't have to do this to me every night. You don't have to. I understand you love me. And then maybe the fear subsides a little bit because you got a chance to get it across to them. So in that regard, that's probably where the fear of parents comes from, where they're like, I don't want to die with, I don't want the kids to.
Do you have an earliest memory that you can identify? Do you know?
I reckon I remember being at my kinder, which I was at like when I was 3 or 4. But all the time I'm doing shit with Sonny. Like, I'm taking him to Trampoline World and he's 2.5. I'm like, you won't remember this. This is bullshit. I spent $40 to get us in here. There's no way you remember this. I can't remember this stuff. And I'm spending every day with you. This is outrageous. But you have to believe somewhere it's laying the foundation for as a dad, I reckon you just add a drip to that barrel and it takes you years to fill up the barrel because every day you just get to put one drip in. And at the end of when the barrel's full, the kid goes, I vaguely remember having fun with you. That's all you get. But it's better than the opposite.
It's amazing how much your parents inform you in ways that you don't understand. That's like, or that you only understand as an adult. You go, oh, that's where I get that from. Or when you meet other people who, like the thing is when you're a kid, it's your entire experience. So it's not until you go out in the world and you hear about other people's same experience that you go, oh, okay, maybe I picked up a few more things.
I think Dad has given me a heavily cynical streak where I can't watch a sporting team lose without thinking they're betting on themselves, which is my dad's. I know that's not true, but I can't. It's the first thought that comes into my head because I've been conditioned by my dad. So yeah, that kind of comes back to a little bit of like my, drilling down on like going, all right, what do I stand for? What do I actually care about day to day? I always try and force myself to make it the tough, in quotation marks, decision of going like, all right, we could just sit on the, you could watch TV and sure, the kids watch, Sonny watches TV. But if I could just push myself a little harder here to think of something, to be creative, to do something fun, it's worth it. He's not going to remember it, but it just seems worthwhile. It's what I want to do. Like, you can be exhausted or whatever, be like, you know what? Let's go looking for Cat Stevens. We'll take a bag of cat biscuits. We'll make an adventure out of it because I'm tired. And maybe it would be more fun if you just watched Cars 3 and I had a sleep and I tucked my finger in your tracksuit pants. So if you got off the couch, I could feel you, which is my other which is my other trick I do. But you know what? Let's go and try and find Cat Stevens because I just think it's worth the effort. I think, and I just firmly believe, like, to create for my kids. And I just know, you know, like, everyone knows tomorrow's not guaranteed. It probably is, but it's not guaranteed to anyone. So that's what comes down to the 80-year-old test to go, I'm probably scared of being regretful that I've wasted moments. That's the other fear too. Like, you're scared that you're going to get to 80 and be like, man, I remember just being at work all the time, or I remember just being on my phone all the time. Like, what was I doing? I had infant children that I could have been enjoying. And so that's a big part of kind of what plays in my head throughout the day.
What was your experience? I don't know much about you growing up. What, do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, older brother, younger sister. Very middle of the road, middle class upbringing.
Middle child.
Very right in the 50th percentile for every experience.
Really came through at the last great gasp of the white man in society. Yeah. Just got
wanted
in
a bike
before
for
the
Christmas.
Line.
Didn't get the best one, but got one.
Got a bike.
You know, wanted Air Jordans, didn't get them, eventually did later.
Yeah.
You know. So basically my memories of childhood are brands and consumerism. But yeah, no. So not like absolutely nothing to gripe about in that regard. Except like it was a really suburban. I had a pretty suburban upbringing, and I think that benefited me in a lot of ways because that's kind of like that's the experience for a vast majority of people. But I remember I was agitated to get on with life. Like I was agitated to seek a bit of adventure. But I was also, you know, being really honest, looking back, I was paralyzed by, I just didn't know what to do about that. Like, it wasn't like a gregarious kid, like, doing cool stuff, like, going, all right, well, I've figured out a way to travel by myself. I was just kind of paralyzed by fear a bit, especially in my teenage years. So I remember being just, like, a bit static and going, I want something different, but I don't know what it is.
What was where do you think the paralysis came from? Because I imagine that's something that many people go through for, you know, in a whole range of ways. You
totally.
Know? Like, but where did that fear come from, or whatever it was for you, do you think?
I think it was just good old-fashioned fear. Like, of going, I don't want to look stupid. I don't want to step out. I don't know. I hadn't figured out yet that life was literally about just if you see... If there's a prize on the shelf, it's going to go to the person that stands up and takes it. Like, I hadn't figured out that, if you, like, you know, if you want to be a comedian, then you just have to get up on stage. Like, no one is stopping you, really.
I mean, it's it of all jobs. Like, you can't say that.
You can't say that as a doctor.
Yeah. You can't, there's plenty of people stopping you. You can't just walk into a hospital and go.
I can think of a dozen regulatory boards that are stopping you.
Stopping you. Plus, security guards.
Plus the legal system.
Doctors. The nurses.
Plus a patient shrieking, yeah. Get him out of here. Get him out of here. That kid's 15.
I imagine there's a series of safeguards. Or we'd hear about it more often, I imagine. Yeah. Amateur surgery. But yeah, like flying a plane. There's things like that, but you're right. Comedy in particular is one of those ones where I often say to young people, if they're asking for advice, I say, not only is it the easiest entry level because they let you do the exact same thing on the first day as the people who've been doing it for 30 years, you know,
yeah.
Like they don't let you use the photocopier on the first day at most jobs. And then the other thing is, no matter how bad you are at it, they don't stop you doing it.
There's no regulatory body.
There's none.
You can't lose your comedy license in New South Wales.
Right.
And, you know, like, if you did, you could go...
Go across the border.
Go to South Australia.
Somewhere no one knows you.
This guy's practicing without a license. So yeah, but I kind of regret that. Like, I look back and I'm a bit disappointed in teenage Hamish because he was a bit of a puss, to be honest.
What would you say to your teenage kids, you know, when they find themselves in a version of that situation?
I reckon I'm a big believer, and I know that any message that comes from your parents is going to be lost.
Right.
So like I'm a big fan. I'm a big reader of the Steve Bidoff books and the, you know, Raising Boys and the Manhood and stuff like that. And a big part of his philosophy and you know, like a growing movement, especially with Raising Boys to not be delinquent, is, I reckon, the importance of having mentors and stuff throughout your teenage years. So you just get to a stage as a boy, like, and we all went through it, where you're like, I'm not going to really listen to dad on how to be a man, like, especially when you're 14, 15. But if you've got good male role models around, that's who you start mimicking. Or if you don't, it's your peer group. And that's kind of like the danger. So I'd try, my goal is when Sonny's that age, that there's good men around him that can be, that he's just going to be a lot more inclined to like listen to those messages from him. Or I'm also a big believer in just a rapid and a massive geographical change. Get away from that basalt. I want you more near more graphite. geographical change. Like I got yanked out of school when I was in year 9, and I was like, this is the end of my world. But I was so unhappy. I knew I was unhappy at the high school I was at. And then I moved schools and I was just like, oh, this is, you know, I'll never recover from this. And then like, and first day in class, I sat next to a guy called Tim Barley, who is now one quarter of Radio Karate, which is our TV production company. There's a guy called Ryan Shelton, who I played basketball with that lunchtime, who's still my best buddy. And we are still making TV together. And so the three of us then met Andy at uni, and that became like the four people that run the TV side of our world. But like, I always look back at it and go, I was screaming to not change schools. Like, I was hysterically screaming. And I know I knew I was unhappy. Like, I know I knew I just wasn't, it wasn't working. I was in the wrong peer group. It just wasn't working. But I was like, I would have done anything to stay in the unhappy situation because I was scared of the change. And then I moved schools and I always look back at it going, oh, what a fucking idiot. Like, just, so if I honestly think if I can see my kids just jammed at a dead end, guys, we're going to Chicago for a year. I don't know. I've always wanted
change
to go.
Something.
Just yep. Change it up. Like a massive change up because anyone's...
It's a good place, by the way, Chicago. I highly recommend that.
All right, really
that.
Interested. Yeah. All right, we'll keep it up the sleeve.
Plus, they shot a lot
Sonny,
of...
Sonny, I don't think you're happy at school. Dad, yeah. I'm so happy. I love school. No, he's not happy. He's unhappy. He doesn't have a good peer group. Yeah. Joshua's my best friend. We're going to Chicago.
Now, watch this episode of The Dark Knight so I can show you all the places they film stuff.
Yeah, and then... In 36 years' time, he'll be sitting here on the couch going, yep. And then my fucking dad took us to Chicago right when things were really clicking when I was 15.
That's my plan for the podcast. I'm only getting people on with kids.
This is
and
a
then
long
I'm gonna,
play.
It's like that movie 7-Up. I'm the new Michael Apted, and I'm going to get the next generation. I'm going to ask everyone about how they planned a parent, and then I'm going to get the kids on 20 years later to ask how it turned out.
Dad is so full of shit, he just spends all his time on his phone. We never looked for that cat.
I remember when Dad ran over a cat and then went home and faked up some missing posters to cover.
Great news about Cat Stevens, though. I mean, if we just want to go back to it, they found him.
Oh, they did.
And I've never seen this before because there's stickers, there's like posters all over the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And the closer we were near his street that he was lost on, the closer we'd get to the street, Sonny would be like, oh, we're getting closer, Dad. He must be around here somewhere. I see more pictures of him. I think in his head it was like a treasure hunt, like someone had hidden Cat Stevens had left clues, and the more pictures we saw, like we'd eventually like pull him out of a hedge and be like, got him. But they went to all the posters in the neighborhood and they put like a found sticker over it, like a sold sticker on a for sale sign, rather than just take the posters down. So now everyone in the neighborhood's like, oh, they found Cat Stevens. Great. But I told Sonny when we like failed to find him this day, I was like, so he's like, Dad, we didn't find him. Like, you know, he's out there somewhere. He's lost. He's all on. I said, it's all right, man. I think Batman's going to find him. Like, we'll turn this over to Batman now. Like, we'll turn this over to the authorities. Like, we couldn't do it as civilians, but Batman will be able to. And so when somebody saw the found stickers, he's like, Dad, Batman found him. He found him. He got him. Like, well, the system works. What did I tell you?
He's
like,
the world's greatest detective for a reason.
I do love the idea, though, that it was just a super slow day for Batman.
Yeah.
Like, the bat signal shines. He's like, Commissioner Gordon, what's up, Joker? Like, nuclear weapon. Yeah. Actually, super slow day. There's this cat called Cat Stevens. Yeah, we can't find him. He's black and white.
Well, you know, the thing is, like, I've always, because I'm a huge Batman fan, but I have always thought that he's probably his most useless of all moves is the standing on the corner of a building and just, like, staring off into the night. It doesn't really feel like
get
that's
a drone,
the most
man.
Efficient way to, like, spot crime, but it'd be a good way to spot a cat. Yeah, so this might...
Just standing on the corner of the building, just, meow, oh, bugger me. Yeah. I was pretty lucky. What are you doing up here, Cat Stevens?
Death is an interesting one to me because normally at the end of the podcast I ask people what they think happens when they die, but because it's come up earlier, let's jump into it.
Let's get it.
What do you think happens?
I think that's it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Right. And that's why I'm so in. I mean, so then, even just thinking about this now, so then why be so obsessed with making sure at 80 you've got this feeling that, okay, I lived every moment. We had a wide tapestry of experiences. I rejected being lazy when the kids were young, and I wanted to, and I put the effort in to try and give them adventures and experiences. If that's all just so I can feel better, and then 2 minutes later I feel nothing, like, that's a lot of effort to just feel better at 80 when you're eventually going to feel nothing anyway. But I think I'm still going with it. I'm not going to be like, oh, well, nothing happens after you die anyway, so who cares about making memories?
I mean, it'd be a terrible podcast if I talked you out of it. You just go home.
You're like, just like, yes, I'm trying to fill up this hard drive with memories, but remember, the hard drives do get erased at the end of it, so what's the point? But I still think I do still think it's worthwhile. Unfortunately, I think.
Well, but that's okay. But that's the essential question of this whole thing, which is, like, if you believe that, you know, often people, you know, use a thing that they believe happens after we die to create meaning for their lives, and that is a legitimate thing to do.
I suppose what I am doing is, like, the closest we've got to life after death is kids, is the people that knew us, loved us, that we impacted. You know, people like yourself included. Like, you know, you've got millions of people that you've impacted, that at least you've added a piece. Like, I know it's a weird thing, probably the weird thing for us to think as humans, because we're like, well, what you mean like one tiny thought or quote, like Stephen Hawking, you know, he recently passed away, and even now his life is getting reduced to quotes, and like, you can be that brilliant, like, but that's the thing, we've had brilliant people, we've had billions of them.
I did notice with the Stephen Hawking thing, there was a lot of just like quotes of him going, look at the stars, don't look at your feet style things, and I'm like, you know, he wrote a whole like book about explain time and the universe, right?
He theorized black holes, and we backed it up later. But we're like, no, just reduce it to the tea towel quotes that we can handle. Man, the saddest thing I thought about Stephen Hawking's death was like half, even like I don't think his body was even cold, and half the headlines were like, you know, he was married 3 times, and he was a little bit of a ladies' man.
He was a real ladies' man, but that's like,
there's been worse ladies' men. Let's focus on the physics and what he's given to humanity.
Well, the other thing about Stephen Hawking is, like, and again, maybe this is it's hard for me to even say this without it feeling like it's going too far, but it's like that idea of going, surely Stephen Hawking was the sort of ladies' man that the lady had to be consensually into the idea of it, because
he needed a captive audience.
Right. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like he was,
I think that's why they were always nurses. Like, and this is how I was as a teen and in my 20s too. Like, I didn't have I wasn't a great looking guy. I didn't have a great bod. I had to play a long game with girls. Like, you know, Stephen, he would have played a very long game. You're in the room with him all day. This guy's super brainy.
I mean, why do you think he theorized what, you know, black holes and the nature of the universe? It was to meet girls. It was to impress girls.
He was like, I'm going to come up with only really long theories that take several hours to explain, so I can get a lot of FaceTime with girls. Yeah. I'm not, like, Pythagoras was an idiot. His theory's over and done with in like 10 words.
Exactly.
So, going back to what we were talking about, I think, like, that's, you know, for me, I think it's over. Unfortunately, there is no immortality, but you do get to pass on your tiny, tiny bit of, if you're lucky, bit of data, bit of imprint onto the next generation. And that iterative process, you know, that's what's given us human culture. And that's kind of all you get. Even if you were brilliant, in the end, you get to put one little piece in the stack.
There's a line of thought that says that we may be the last generation of people who actually do die, in the sense that we understand what death is. That
escape velocity.
Our consciousness might be, our consciousness.
Could be captured.
Could be captured and put into our artificial intelligence.
I was reading about this.
Live on. Is that something that you, do you feel about that?
I was reading about this the other day. So Ray Kurzweil, you know Ray Kurzweil, the futurist?
I do. I have actually met him. I did a gig with him.
That would be awesome. Was it good?
He's the guy who sort of posited the idea of the singularity originally. And he's one of those guys who, like, has some great title at Google, like Chief Futurist or something like that, you know.
Which is less testable than pastist historian.
So he was, one of the things he said was that the trickiest thing for AI to replicate was humor. Because humor is like something that is a little bit hard to, it's why people get so, and I'm sure you've experienced this over the years, you know, people will say of someone, and you see it all the time, that person's not funny or that person's shit. And you're like, well, I mean, clearly they're funny to a whole bunch of people because they've like had 20 years of a career.
They're
like
still there.
Entertaining people.
A Carrot Top is still there in Vegas. It might not be your thing, but he's there.
But it's one of those things, I think, comedy that is even unexplainable to human beings in a sense of like,
there's no algorithm yet.
Right.
Yeah. And for every time that you think there's a rule, that's just the rule until someone can disprove it, and that's the new funny way of doing it. So in terms of capturing,
yes,
I mean, yeah, if you could completely capture every synapse and every part of the human brain. There was the thing that I was reading the other day was about the escape velocity, which is the point in the technological evolution of anti-aging and life extending technologies where for every year that you live, your life expectancy grows by more than a year. So as we're getting kind of like more specific DNA medications for cancer and things like that, and CRISPR technologies can make up, you know, you can get a nanobot that can now like invade a cell in your body and destroy anything it wants. So as that's advancing, like, so yeah, maybe for people under 50, we'll hit escape velocity where our life extending technology like outstrips how fast we're just naturally decaying. It's a really weird one because you're like, I don't know if our brain is ready to live forever. I think it could be humanities. There's the theory too that there could be humanity's leap from being humans to gods. Like, we'll now be immortal, literally, we'll be gods and we can create things. But geez, I mean, I don't want to shock anyone here, but it's going to be a doozy when it happens. if I can reduce it to that, that's going to be a doozy because I just think we're going to, like, you know, talking about Sonny being born, I'm sure that experience isn't unique to me going, oh my God, I'm going to die. I've just realized this, that I'm mortal. We all know it. Like, that's part of being human. Like, we all know we've got, I mean, will it just strip meaning out of life? Like, will everything become, like, I can just do that later because I have infinity time now up my sleeve? It might, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how much we'll want it. Or I probably, like, with a lot of this stuff, we might split. Like, as soon as we can put software in our heads and we can have, you know, neural links and people can, you can learn a language in 10 seconds because you have half, you have a bit of hardware in your brain that you can put programs on. Maybe half of humanity goes, yeah, I want that. And the other half goes, I'm going to stay OG. I'm going to stay totally organic. And we might split. Like, maybe this is the start of a split. So yeah. I don't know if I would want it.
It's interesting to me because...
Am I very, very old when... do I keep aging physically?
Well, I imagine that you don't keep aging physically at some point, right? Mm. Or I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't have the technology available, so I can't run you through.
I got a few body issues, and I know you do too. Like, yeah. I'd take pain free.
Oh yeah, totally.
I would just take pain free.
Oh yeah, robot from the waist down. I'd be very happy with, to be honest. I am interested in, I guess, the advance of technology and how quickly it's happening.
Yeah,
and how terrifying that can be, because we're moving house. Obviously, you're in my very minimalist new house. That
there's literally nothing downstairs except a gas fire, so it looks a bit evil there. It's like polished concrete floors and one of those pebble gas fires.
Yeah, and just some plastic wrapping on the floor, and I made you stand in the middle of it. So we were going through the attic in Sydney the other night, and there's stuff in there that was put in that attic 13 years ago when we moved into the house and hasn't emerged from the attic in those 13 years.
What's your time capsule?
Well, you know what the thing is? The further you went back into the attic, it was like you were going further and further back through time. And like, it reminded you how quickly, because it's only 12 or 13 years.
Yeah, like if you find old phones and old cameras... Like, remember digital cameras?
They
used to be a thing.
Boxes of videotapes. I couldn't believe that videotapes were still in the last 10 or 12 years. Boxes of videotapes.
Yeah, mini DV.
And the other one is that we had floppy disks. Not the full on old floppy ones, but the hard floppy in the middle.
Don't try and say you had the cool floppy. It was just 3.25 and not the 5.5. I wasn't using this on an Atari or Commodore 64. This was an IBM floppy disk.
But it speaks to the idea of how quickly the technology advances.
In year 12, I finished year 12 in 1999, and I went to high school in Victoria. And we had to do things called CATS, like, you know, your big assessment for the year, like similar to what I'm sure they've got today. And we would have them, and they were just Word documents, but I still remember going to school every day with a floppy in my top pocket going, like 100% going, I'm at school in the future. Like, I have a computer disk in my pocket, and I would never, God, imagine if I could have told myself in primary school, I would have a computer disk in my pocket. I'm a cyborg. And now, like... I'm like, now it's insane what kids are doing at school. And I've got a similar drawer of technology that I've kept deliberately for that reason. Like, every phone I've owned, I had an iPhone 1, like a cracked iPhone 1. And I was just like, I've got to keep this for my kids. You go and pick it up. And like, at that stage, they were future kids. It feels like it's bubbled. Do you know what I mean? Like, they were very, very round. They were like very three-dimensional first iPhones. Now they're flat. Like, we just think of them as flat bits of technology. But it looks like someone's got a current iPhone and put about 10 times atmospheric pressure in it, because they're just like, they're like little Lilos. Like, they're so fat, those original phones. And that's an iPhone, which at the time was insane.
I remember going overseas, and when I was probably 20 or something, and I had one of the first, you know, flip phone, Motorola, you know, mobile phones. And I'm in Times Square in New York City, and I ring someone in Australia, and I am just like, my mind is more blown by the fact that we are speaking in real time between New York City in Australia, and yet now we have video phones.
It's
and
crazy.
We just like
to, it, and kids get them too, like if Zoe's away for the night or something, or I'm away for the night and we FaceTime, no problem for a three-year-old to hold a phone and go, how's it going, dad?
Yeah,
I understand,
just
you're on
used
a phone.
To it.
Yeah, what's this, what is this, just data streaming, who cares? Yeah, that's fine. I totally understand that as a child, and it blows our mind. But then you hear those quotes where you're like, oh, but everyone in their generation thinks that technology is accelerating so fast, and if you were living in the 1400s, you'd think that the new boats being built were a huge acceleration of technology. But I go, I don't
is
know.
That true?
I feel like...
I reckon if it took 4 years for them to build a boat, it'd feel like 4 years, yeah. Right?
Well, but they're like, but look at our new sail ship compared to like what we had. You know, 10 years ago, we were in this piece of shit, and now we've got this like 100 cannons or whatever. There's always that argument made of like, to your generation, it seems like, you know, that old adage of like, oh, it seems like teenagers don't listen to their elders, and it's just the same for every generation. Even though I hear that, I still go, you know, I feel like our generation's really booming. Like,
I think there's a rapid increase in it, and I think that our capacity to understand the side effects of it is not advancing at the same rate as the technology advances.
And that's like, we have whatever it is, you know, 500,000 year old brain largely unchanged in our heads, and then suddenly if you're telling that brain and we, you know, the cognitive process we've inherited and we've had to like pretty quickly adapt to modern technology, if you're telling that brain, oh, by the way, now you don't die, I think that's a pretty big shift for that brain to kind of make out of left field. But it fascinates me, all this stuff. Like, I'm deeply fascinated by it. But the thing that probably excites me the most is like, we just don't know. Like, that we really don't know. Like, we get a vague idea of like, I think it's going to be AI, and it's probably going to be specific medicines and machine learnings, you know, that's, you know, but we really, I love this frontier, and there's definitely stuff you can read that makes you less scared about it. There's a book called The Rational Optimist, which is a pretty good book to like not panic about the future. Like, it makes a pretty good argument to go, all right, well, this is exciting. Like, we've always kind of ended up on our feet as humans, even if we've had bad patches. But one thing I read once that always strikes me as super, super interesting is like, there was a study where they asked a lot of people in the 60s, like, all right, what's the future going to look like? Or it might have been 1970. What's the future going to look like? And everyone was like, everyone gave amped up versions of current technology. So everyone's like, well, there'll be mini nuclear weapons and we'll be living on the moon because we just went there. And cars seem to be getting better. They'll probably fly. And planes will be, let's say, 10 times as fast, because everyone's just like, we understand what we've got now, so there'll just be better versions of that. But no one predicted the internet. And that's easily the biggest change that humanity's been through in the last 50 years is the internet. So I was like, all right, well, what's the thing that we're not seeing? Like, what's the 50 years from now in 2068? What's the internet that we are completely blind to now? And hopefully it's something that doesn't destroy our race.
How do you... you talked about when you were a kid having fear. Do you have fear as an adult? Like, you know, that same sort of fear that, you know, about, you know, throwing yourself into a project or things that you're doing in your life. Is that still something that you, you know, live with that's part of you?
I do. I wish I didn't. But then I think, and I'd almost ask the same question of yourself too, but I believe it doesn't go away. You just have to understand it better. Like, especially if you're maybe, and like our experience is the creative side of things. Well, I'm sure if you're a scientist too and you've got a hunch for a theory that you want to investigate, or if you're a dancer and you're like, God, I want to dance my way and I'm going to do it different. You know, whatever you are, whatever your field is where you're trying to put something out there that you're... that resonates with you, or whatever it is you're trying to spend your time on, for whatever you're pursuing. I don't think that fear goes away, and I'm not sure it should. I probably spend a lot of my life going, I'd love to get to the stage where I'm not nervous anymore. Like, you probably tend, I think people, well, I tended to see it as a weakness or as something I'd like to get rid of. But then as I think as I've got older, I think the truth or the answer or a good place to be mentally is to know that that fear is always going to be there and it serves a good purpose, but you just have to learn to dance with it a little bit better. Like you just have to learn to kind of just feel it and proceed anyway.
Well, that's an interesting thing to say because I think that, the idea that it might go away, you know, there's people who are born without the whatever it is that, you know, makes fear work in your head.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I'm proper sciencey and stuff. But it's actually really terrible for you. People might imagine it'd be great to be fearless, but, you know.
Yes, you're flying a plane with no warning signs.
Right, you're walking into traffic.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
You just, like, your brain doesn't compute that car coming in the opposite direction is, you know, fear's there for a reason.
Totally. It serves a purpose. You're going to, I mean, I'm probably a bit of an overthinker too, so you're gonna make sure it doesn't run out of control and just become pointless anxiety.
Right. So how do you deal with that? I guess that's what I'm asking about.
Yep.
It's like when fear is rearing, you know, its head and you go, I have to now deal with this fear in a constructive way. Do you have like a way that you do that? Is there a process to that?
I reckon it's somewhere along the line, like in terms of like my self-talk is if you let this, like I think because a lot of times the fear just wants to stop you, right? Like for whatever reason, like the fear is telling you just stop, just don't do the thing, don't take a risk, just stop, which is in the good version, that's clever because that was the edge of the cliff. So I'm glad you stopped. But in the irrational version or the anxiety version, it's just telling you to stop and to check yourself. And if it's something that I know is not actually dangerous, if I know it's something like, well, it's like it's saying something on radio or coming up with an idea or trying to do something funny, to me, the antidote is to just even if you ever break it down into baby steps, to just start doing the thing anyway. Just gently start doing it, and I find as I do it, that fear dissipates eventually. But if I don't do it, I think there's a level of regret. I know I'll feel a level of regret there later, where I'm like, why didn't I just do it? Like, why didn't I just do the thing? Why did I listen to the fear and I sat still? And now, a day later, I could have had an experience, whether it went well or not, I would have been richer for it. But I think maybe I'm fighting fear with fear. I'm going, don't listen to this fear because I'm scared of in a day from now regretting not doing anything, if that makes sense.
No, that makes absolutely perfect sense. We have to finish up in a minute because I have to go and get an MRI today. So I apologize that we're going to have to cut it a bit shorter than usual because I would have liked to keep talking to you for a very long time.
I have a fear of cutting interviews short, but you're watching sorry me live, deal with it.
I have a fear of dying from whatever this lump is in my neck. So, you know.
Do you have a lump in your
neck? I actually don't have a fear from that. I wish I probably should have more of a fear from that.
Well, as we've learned, your superpower is you can die at any time.
Any time.
Is it a lump in the neck thing?
I've got a tumor in my neck, but it's benign.
Fatty?
Well, they think it's think it's benign. No need to insult me, mate. Rub it in.
I found a lump in my back, and they're like, "Oh, that's just fat." I was like, "It seems to be renegade fat that's like bundled together as
yeah,
a team."
Mine is they believe a schwannoma or something. There's some like this is how you're blasé.
I've had my share of tests over time. I'm sure you have too. And if there's one thing I've learned, it's like just let the doctors be doctors.
Right?
Like don't look at Google because I was like, you know what? I was like 100%. God damn it! I've got a freaking brain tumor. My ear hurts. That's right where I would hold my phone. Like, what an idiot. What am I doing? I knew I should have gone hands-free. Listen to mum. Get that weird phone case that's got the electromagnetic chip in it or whatever that sucks the negative energy out. And I just had a strained jaw muscle. So like,
right.
And I remember I'm looking at the scan of my head, my brain, which is like was very very clear of all tumors, still being like, I couldn't believe it. I was just like, this is incredible. I can't believe I was just 100% convinced I had brain cancer. I've had testicular cancer 5 or 6 times. It's always from bike riding. And I've recovered every time because the doctor's gone, hey, have you had a new seed or something? Like, I did get a new seed. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a chance that's what it is. I would have guessed. Yeah, I've had this lump for ages. They did a biopsy and everything to make sure, but it's been, and they basically said at the time, we're not going to do anything about it unless it starts giving you some trouble. And then the other day, I was like, I don't think I'm breathing very well. Would you think that's trouble? So,
Anderson's going back in. Wants to breathe all day long. Enjoy your breaths. Now, can we get back to treating real patients? You know, that's good. That's
well, you know,
that's
the thing
legit.
About it is, it's like that thing of I should be more. I realize that like I only have one skill that pays my bills, which is the ability to essentially yeah. talk.
I need air.
So I need air.
I need like, air. It's a very, very cheap overhead, but I need it.
I don't want to be a prima donna about it. I just need to be able to breathe.
Just a regular sea-level oxygen saturation. I'm not asking for fresh air or anything.
Oh, no, we don't need a humidifier.
Yeah. I'll even sometimes put smoke in the air as a bit of a laugh.
Oh, yeah, it's fine.
But I do need enough air to breathe.
Just need some of it to be able to breathe. Well, just really to be able to put it into my body.
Yeah, it's just a bellows. It's a basic bellows system, and yeah. Then I will get out of your hair.
The environment is supplying the air for free. I just need some sort of way to suck it into my body.
You won't even notice it's gone. Yeah. I'm going to take hardly any.
Yes, but I do, I don't have that level of fear for that. But I do have fear when it comes to...
Performing, coming up with new material?
But new material. Like, yep. I mean, that fear that, you know, I was talking to Dave Thornton about this the other day, which is that idea of just the idea that almost every comedian at some stage gets to that point where they're not as funny as they used to be.
Sure. Like or you have that golden 2 years where you are what the world needed.
Right.
And not everyone can, you don't get to be there forever. Well, I mean, I'm just talking about comics. I've not experienced it. But you see, like, comics going, right, you were what like Paul Reiser, you were what the world needed.
Right.
And you were global.
Everyone was mad about you.
But you're not going to be, we're not going to be mad about you forever. No. And I still want, I'm like, are you okay with that, Paul Reiser? Because, you know, no one said you're going to get it forever. I hope you enjoyed your 2 years.
And there's you understand that at all times.
Yeah.
You know, you understand that at all times that at some stage people are not going to be as interested in it as they are
100%.
Now. And I think that's the new phase of fear in my life. Is like, when is it now? Like, yeah. In the old days, like,
or has it been happening for 3 years and I still think I'm there?
In the old days, it used to be that thing of like, if a joke didn't work on stage, you'd be like, oh, well, I'll just get that joke right. Whereas now, if a joke doesn't work, I go, well, I guess that was it. That was it. Yeah. That's it. Oh, well, I had a good run.
Well, I've always wanted to operate a gondola. I wonder if I could get a job at a ski field.
You know what I'm going to do? Some emergency amateur surgery. I'm just going to give it a crack.
I'm going to find another industry that you need no license to do.
How many safeguards can there actually be? Well, Hamish, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Mate,
thank you so much for making the effort to do it. I really appreciate it.
I love that you do this podcast.
Thank
it's
you.
Awesome.
Well,
thanks,
is there anything that we can plug? You have a podcast.
Nah, I mean, yeah, we did a good job at the start. It's, you know, if you've downloaded this, you know how to podcast.
Oh, so. What about is there anything else though? You can plug anything else. It doesn't have to be about you. Zoe got a book out or something?
Oh, yeah, I mean, Zoe's always doing stuff. She's prolific. Yep. I mean, again, I don't know when this is launching, but she's guaranteed to have a product or a book out this week. Breakup Boss, if you're going through a breakup, is a terrific, I think that's a terrific service that she's providing for heartbroken people. Big summer of cricket coming up this year.
Big summer of cricket.
Go Aussies.
What do you, are you, what is your sport of choice? You're a Melbourne Football Club fan.
I'm
right?
a Melbourne Footy Club fan. And I do love footy. I'm not evangelical about it. Like I don't, you know, like well, for the club's own good, I turned down the number one ticket holder a few years ago. And it went to Ron Barassi. I'm like, well, that seems like a bit
weird
of
weird that was the pecking
seems
order.
Seems like a bit of a benefit, don't you reckon? I feel like, well, what's he done for the club? Sorry, I didn't know you're just going to give it to anyone. No, I'll take it back. I'll have it. Thank you. Tell Ron I'd like it back. But you know what I mean? I'm like, yeah, I'll get to like 5 or 6 games a year, but like,
I also just love the person in the office who's putting together that list. Like, yeah, but you're juggling that. I mean, all due respect
Isn't
to you.
Isn't that Ron
but...
guy that keeps calling? Should we give it to him? He seems persistent. But I'm a big cricket fan as well. Like I do love.
I
grew up playing cricket. No, I'm a big cricket fan.
So when you say big cricket fan, so like I mean, just to finish on a bit of fun. But are you like following the series in South Africa at the moment?
We have done, yes. Although I mean, this is the day. I'm not sure what happened to Rabada. Have they dropped him?
Well, basically, at the stage we're recording this, so Rabada got their fast bowler who ripped through us in the second test, has now been suspended, but now they're launching a protest.
It's not for was it for the shoulder bump? Was he suspended for the
shoulder
contact? Well,
he's got a whole bunch of points already. This is what people wanted to hear at the end, isn't it? A discussion of the point system.
A discussion
around...
of Will and I trying to dissect the ICC's point system in another country.
There's
off,
a point
off
system.
Off vague headlines we might have read.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And based on a story that actually everybody will know what happened.
Inside out. And he's probably been reinstated.
All right, good point. All right, well, thank you very much for being part of it, mate. It was
Thanks,
nice
man.
To do.
Good luck with the MRI.